Ceremony 2014.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Joel, ladies and gentlemen. It's a pleasure to be here and a pleasure to once again be able to present some awards in this field. And I've done this now for a few years. I'm happy to say that this year, we had more nominations for awards and more nominations of even the same organizations for awards than we have had in the past. I think that's wonderful. It shows an increase in interest. And while it did make our job more challenging because we had, you know, more things to look over and more consideration to give, it was heartening to see how much is going on out in the field. We give awards in the performing arts, media, museums, the international arena, and we have two awards that honor individuals, the Dr. Margaret R. Fanstill Memorial Achievement Award for Research and Development, and the Barry Levine Memorial Award for Career Achievement in Audio Description. Starting off with performing arts, one of the leading regional presenting organizations in the nation is getting this award today. To quote from its two nominations, thanks to the Arch Center, blind and visually impaired people now have access to full-length opera, masterpieces of the classical repertoire, as well as exciting musicals. The describers used are professional, eloquent, and succinct in the crafting of their descriptions. The system used is of top quality, and everyone at the center is knowledgeable, welcoming, and encourages participation in audio-described performances. This group has developed a top-notch audio description program, and we hope that this award will encourage them to keep the program going and build it up further and further. Congratulations to the Adrian Arch Performing Arts Center in Miami, Florida.
All right. Here's the certificate. You can give it back to me.
I can give it back to you. Okay.
And accepting the award for the Adrian Arch Center is
Joel Snyder.
Joel Snyder. Right.
For now.
Hello. Thank you so much. On behalf of the... No. All right.
And I guess I should mention also that one of the things that helped us make this the winner of the award this year was that blind people themselves got up and asked us to consider giving these people an award, and that helped us make the decision. Now, for the media award, we go to a group not from the United States, but from a country known for many, many innovations in audio description. It's the very important description work done by a person who I do believe is here today, Diane Johnson.
Whoa.
And Descriptive Video Works. Descriptive Video Works has done thousands of hours of movies and TVs. I like them because they did 179 hours of I Love Lucy. And I Love Lucy. They've done over 300 feature films. Diane is a tireless advocate, a founding member of Canadian Described Video Broadcasting Committee. And Diane, why don't you come on up? Congratulations for all that you do. Well, you're very welcome.
Thank
you're very
you.
Welcome. You want to say something?
I'd just like to say thank you very much to the committee. And it's been wonderful to be here for this conference. It's been amazing, the networking, the sessions, and meeting just about everybody in the room here. Thank you so much.
All right. Well, thank you.
Yeah, that's fine, Diane. I want to know how you did the conveyor belt episode of I Love with which one? Oh, I want to see. Yeah, I want to see that. I want to see the chocolate factory. That does everybody remember that episode of I Love Lucy? I want to hear that. That would be great fun. I'm going to use that in training or something. That's great. Congratulations, Diane.
Yeah, I've heard some. They're very good. Very good. Now we come to the area of museums and audio description within museums. This award goes to a program this year that focuses on children. It's the Connecticut Children's Museum in New Haven. It nurtures children. My planner's going off on me. It nurtures children and their families in a literacy-based environment. So we get not only stimulation, but literacy at the same time. They have audio-described tours for children. When you go into the museum, you're greeted by four life-size, touchable, flat metal sculptures of children frolicking. They can be right side up, upside down. It's quite a deal. There's one in a wheelchair on a grassy lawn. You have wall-mounted tactile maps, and they have Braille as well as the tactile shape of the map. Each room in the museum has a map and a description. In the music room, they've got a brass saxophone mounted about the height a child would want it to play it or play with the keys and so forth. In another area, you can Braille a letter, weigh it. You can determine the location on a tactile globe, where it's going to go. And so we're happy and pleased to present this award to Sandy Malmquist and the Connecticut Children's Museum in New Haven, Connecticut. Congratulations.
I will accept that award for Sandy and the Connecticut. I have been there, and it really is an amazing place. Children's museums are not just for children, let me tell you. This is a lot of fun. So if ever New Haven, check it out.
Child in you, Joel.
That's where I brought out the child in me, yes. Yeah.
Now we come to the International Achievement Award. And earlier today, you heard from Stephanie Kirkland from Vocali Descriptive Arts Society yesterday in Vancouver, British Columbia. Great city, by the way. They're growing all the time. In 2010, they did 15 productions. This year, by August, they will have done 26. They've done 81 productions for over 400 individuals in the British Columbia area. Something that they excel in and make a part of their presentations is what they call the touch tour. And people are invited to go up on stage, see the costumes, check out the design, and in the nomination, we certainly came to understand how important that was for blind folks in British Columbia to experience. So, Steph Kirkland, come on up. The two international people from Canada are here.
Canada,
I
yeah.
I love that.
Canada's taken over. What is that? Huh. Yeah, that's right. You too, Deb Fels.
Hi there. What
is this Canada Day?
Nice to meet you. You want to say a few words? Why not?
I'm a little bit overwhelmed. Thank you so much, and we are the new kid on the block, that's for sure. And I'm just so inspired by everyone I've met here, and everyone, all the work that everyone is doing. This award and all of your work is what keeps me going, and the encouragement that I'm getting here is just, I can't tell you how valuable it is. And from our patrons in Vancouver, I wouldn't be here without them. So thank you.
We now move to the Margaret Fansteel Award for Research and Development. And you've had some people from the U.S. and think, you know, you've had some from the North in Canada. Now, think East. And the winner this year is Dr. Louise Fryer of London in the United Kingdom, so quite a ways east, actually. She's got a PhD in audio description-related fields, and she truly is one of the leading researchers in the field today. One of her specialties, by the way, is audio describing dance and movements within dance, which is a pretty darn hard thing to do. To give you an idea of her papers, one of them is called "Can You Feel What I'm Saying? The Impact of Verbal Information on Emotion, Elicitation, and Presence in People with a Visual Impairment." That sounds pretty heavy, doesn't it? Another one is "Audio Drama and the Imagination: The Influence of Sound Effects on Presence in People with and Without Sight." And just one more to give you a feel for what she does: "Audio Description as Audio Drama: A Practitioner's Point of View." So, congratulations go from us to Louise Fryer.
Yes.
For her great work in this field.
What's that feel?
Okay. And finally, today we have the Barry Levine Memorial Award for Career Achievement. And Barry, many of you may have known Barry, he was really in charge of an organization that preceded what we're doing today. They wanted to do more, but somehow the timing wasn't right, or it didn't work out right or something, and they folded. But Barry stuck around. We got this project going, as Joel said, in 2009. And we honor him, his memory, and his commitment to excellence and belief in audio description. This year, the award is going to a person who is well known to all of us, a person I've known for probably 15, 18 years now. It's hard to believe. A person who's worked in audio description for at least 30 years. He may have gotten his start just as a person reading to blind folks and became aware of the need to do this kind of work and aware of the need for describing things for the blind. He was personally acquainted with and worked with the Fan Steels at the, what was it, the Washington Ear, I think it was called, and has become internationally known training throughout the world in the field of audio description. Just to show us all up, he decided to get a PhD this year and has written the book, The Visual Made Verbal. The awardee this year is our very own Joel Snyder.
Hey.
Wait a second. Thanks, Chris. Wow. Well, thank you, Chris, and thank you to everybody that's here. This is really important and very much appreciated. We do this for, I think I've mentioned this already once or twice, our clients who are the people who are blind or have low vision. And it has been a great privilege to be able to do that for 30-some years and to know people and get to know people well, like Chris Gray and Kim Charlson and Barry Levine and other consumers of audio description. That's what's really important, and it's nice to know that I've had some impact on all of that. So thank you, Chris, and thank you, everybody here. And all of our award winners, by the way, will receive a handsome cherrywood plaque, which unfortunately are not available right now, Steph and Diane. Yeah, there you go, there you go. But you will receive that via parcel post or whatever it is. So thank you. Thank you, Chris.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Joel. And just as a follow-up, Just as a follow-up, many of you may know this, but I can't help but highlight it before I step away from the microphone. Joel is a person who not only talks the talk, he walks the walk, in the sense of wanting to do things for blind people and do things correctly. You know, a lot of people who put together that White House tour would have insisted on voicing it themselves. That would have just been what they would have to do. Joel went out and found a blind person in D.C., a great radio figure, and had him do it because he was blind. And because he was a good exactly. presenter as well. I mean, that was equally important. In Joel's work with the Park Service, he always, and I know this from personal experience, goes out and gets at least one blind person to go with him to work through all the description for the tours and see what makes sense. So thank you, Joel, for doing it both ways. And thank you all very much for your attention and for the opportunity to present these awards today.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you're great. Thank you so much. You've got a great fun. And you need to get to your other appointment. Oh, you want to get to Kenny? Well, do that for you. And just pass Deb. It's on the floor there. On your right. Yeah. You're stepping on it. Okay. Well, are you going to want to speak from there or up here? Come up here?
No, I'm going to come up.
Oh, good. Okay, good. No, you bet. You bet. Let us continue with our keynote speaker, Dr. Deborah Fels, Professor Dr. Deborah Fels. She is a full professor now, by the way, she just told me. You know, before I voice introduction I have on the screen here, I want to just welcome a special guest. We have with us Mary Frances Andrews. Yeah, she's looking around. Evan, that's what I said, Evans. Mary Frances Evans. Oh, Lord. Who's Mary Frances Andrews, then? I don't know. No, Roy, I've had too much on the whatever. Mary Frances Evans is here. The thought is what that counts. From the Iowa, ISIS.
IRIS.
See, I can't do anything today. I'm so flustered. I kind of liked ISIS, like ISIS and Osiris, whatever. Yeah, right. No, IRIS, the Iowa Reading Radio Information Service.
Good
enough. Got it. Something like that. Which is just Peg, of course, from Kansas and has been associated with, oh boy, here I go. IAIIS, whatever. Yeah, something like that. The International Association of Information Audio Systems, whatever, services. And so...
audio description is a precise science.
Right, something like that. Yeah, right. But, no, it's fun to have Mary Frances here because, like Peg, she is a fan of audio description. You know, audio description was birthed as the first formal ongoing service was birthed by our radio reading service. So I think they have a special role in the history of audio description. And I had the privilege of training some describers with Mary Frances, a year ago or something. And you guys have gone on doing all kinds of description gangbusters. I know that. And not only that, she makes darn sure that the current one of the senators from Iowa, Senator Harkin, who is, many of you may know, really the father of the Americans with Disabilities Act. He is just an amazing man, and Mary Frances made sure that he knows about audio description. I've met him a couple of times. I've made sure he knows about audio description. And unfortunately, he's retiring at the end of his term, so we're going to lose his advocacy and support. But
he's going to join our team.
Oh, there you go. He's going to be a reader. I love it. Okay. Anyway, welcome, Mary Frances. Deb Fels is a professor in the School of Information Technology. Technology management at Ryerson University in Toronto, Canada again, goodness.
That's all right. She has a special research interest in access to computing systems for people with disabilities. One of her various projects involving audio description includes the development of described episodes of Odd Job Jack. I think you're going to get a look at
a little bit
of that. Yeah, an animation series produced for the Comedy Network. Now, I've seen these. This is cool. The descriptions for the animation are unique in that they have first-person narrative descriptions synchronized with nonverbal sounds in addition to the silenced-only portions, as well as user-controlled extended descriptions. This is the kind of research and kind of development that I think the field needs. Find new ways to make description available in better quality and more often in lots of different ways. Deb Fells was the 2013 of our very own Fan Steele Memorial Achievement Award in audio description research and development, and it's just great that she could find time to be with us today. Deborah Fells. Yeah. Yeah.
I could do that, or I could move. I could move.
You can dance around. I'll sit down.
Okay. Great. I'm not a big fan of those podiums because I'm really short.
You wouldn't
and,
be able to see her then.
I'm like, hello.
You have to get some phone books.
No. I know. That's right. I have to get phone books. Okay. So I'm just going to move around. Okay. So first of all, thank you for inviting me and having me here. And thank you for the award last year. I was very honored and our research team was very honored. The award has a very prominent place in my lab. So what I'm going to do with you today, and you know, please, if you want to ask questions, I like this to be interactive. I'm a professor, so you know, if you want to interrupt, that's fine with me. This is not a scientific conference or anything, so please. So I'm going to go through just a little bit of theoretical stuff that we work with, not too much, just a little bit. And then I'm going to tell you about some of the work that we've done from the past and what we're continuing to do and try and give you a couple of examples. All right, so I just want to introduce a couple of models of disability that are around. And the one that was prominent in the past is the medical model of disability. And the graphic shows the individual with a sad face as being the problem. And in the old days, and a little bit now still, a person with a disability is looked at as a problem that needs to be fixed. And that individual is really what the focus is. Society doesn't have any responsibility for dealing with the needs and abilities of that individual. The new model, which tends to be very prominent in the disability studies arena, is the social model of disability. And that looks at the person as a part of society, and that society has the responsibility to break down barriers and not erect barriers so that individuals with all kinds of abilities can participate on an equal level. And so, you like that model? I like that model too. Yay! And so, the research that we do in my lab, in all kinds of different areas, we try really hard to take this point of view of the theory and of the work that we do. So that's our where we're informed. Oops, I missed one. Yes, okay. And then, stemming from this social model of disability is a couple of design strategies. And I work in the assistive technology, inclusive media area. So design is a very prominent part of the work that we do. We tend not to do so much theoretical work. We do more design and engineering kind of work. And so we work with a couple of other of design models. One is the universal design model. And I noticed yesterday that it was up on one of the slides. the word universal design. Oh, yeah. I am not sure how much it was discussed, but it's a U.S.-based model. And essentially, it says that technology and design systems should be made to work with a diverse audience. And essentially, if you look at the websites and stuff, it says everybody. I'm not sure if that's 100% practical, but it's a good place to work. And that when you do something like this, you actually make technologies and systems available to a very diverse audience, including people with disabilities and people who are learning disabilities, but people, a whole range of people. And one of the important tenets of this is that the work needs to begin at the beginning of the design, not at the end. All right, and I have a couple of pictures up here just to give you the kind of diversity I'm talking about. The picture on your left is from Gallaudet University, and the design of their spaces. So people who are deaf are very visual and need, they have a very great need to have a lot of visual information in their environments. And so things like railings and staircases, things like that, have a lot of glass and clear designs. The hallways are very open, not many visual objects in the way, so that people who are deaf can see. And then we have a couple of other pictures of some interesting wheeled devices, which were designed for people with mobility issues. And one is with a fellow on a skateboard-like device and a suitcase that is part of the skateboard so that he can push his suitcase along with the skateboard. I'd like to have one of those, I'll tell you. It's airport. And then there are people who are suspended, their bodies are suspended on a tricycle looking device, and they're able to control that device with their hands instead of their feet. So we have lots of different opportunities in the universal design world. In the UK, they've modified this concept of universal design to consider as many people as possible rather than everybody. So that is called inclusive design, and those two models are related. And the image shows a wine bottle, essentially, on its side, where you have a whole lot of people in the one end, the very fat end of the wine bottle, and then it gets slimmed down in the neck of the wine bottle, and fewer people at the very top. And what we want to try and do is include as many of the people in the wine bottle as possible, realizing we may not be able to get to the ends. Now, what I say to my colleagues who are working on data analytics and big data, everybody heard about this craze, big data? Yes, of course. Well, that's about averages. And as you know, the majority. And I say, no, you don't deal with the majority. You deal with the ends, and you get everybody in between. So they look at me funny when I say that. But that's what I think they should do. And I'm going to work on that. Okay. And one of the things that my very good colleague, Yuta Trevoranis, talks about quite a lot is the one-size-fits-one as a concept, as part of the inclusive design methodology. And what we're starting to see now is kind of a fall to the the 1800s, when you could get clothing designed for you, tailor-made. That was sort of the norm. Right now, it's a very expensive kind of process. Nobody does that. And so there's a couple of companies that are offering this sort of concept of one size fits one, where you go to the website. One is called Spreadshirt. And it's in the UK, and I have the website if you're interested. But the name is called Spreadshirt. So you go on this this website, and you can order, one sleeve as a medium length, and the other sleeve as a large or long length. You can order the torso to be medium and the back to be long or whatever, large. And then they'll just put it together for you. Whatever, all the pieces that you order, they'll put it together. And the price is about the same as, you know, a T-shirt that you would buy, maybe not in the Las Vegas souvenir store, but as, you know, a regular department store. And we're seeing a number of businesses that are embracing this idea that that we can design for one. And the last little theory part, sorry about that, is that really has a relationship to entertainment, to audio description, is the concept of entertainment theory, and that comes from the theater world. And I just met a person from New Zealand, and he told me that he loved the audio description for Borat. The show, the movie, Borat, because he said that the describer got some of the visual jokes and actually described them. And he said, but the worst thing was that she missed a bunch of them and she didn't make it very funny. So that is the foundation of entertainment theory, is that the entertainment experience is what is important in a piece of content. And that the theory says that the director or the creative team, depending on how it's done, is actually responsible for the control and design of that experience. And their job, then, is to make sure that it's done accurately and effectively to their vision, not to our vision as an audience. They don't actually care much about us as an audience, but to themselves. So they take a story or an idea, and they mold that with scriptwriters, with actors, into something that they think is entertaining. Sometimes that works and sometimes that doesn't. And so they are responsible then for taking all the parts and putting it together into one thing. Now, what that doesn't include, in all the literature at least, is audio description and captioning either. But as far as I'm concerned, those are parts. The audience, who's blind or deaf, that's how they consume that particular piece of content. So from an entertainment theory point of view, audio description is no different than set design or costume design. It's all part of the whole. And if you don't have it, then the audience who needs it won't be able to access it. Okay. So, let's get back to the work that we do. Any questions about that? I know theory's kind of boring, but I hope it helps you understand where we come from. It should help to inform maybe where you come from. Okay, so we started our work with captioning. Because, as you know, and I just had a chat with Jolynn. Where is she? Yeah, there she is. About this. The deaf community makes a lot of noise. So they get first dibs. Most things. And when I looked at captioning, you know, as an example, everybody always trots it out as the example of universal design in media. But there is no way it is. It's not even close. Yes, okay. The broadcasters now have to have 100%, more or less. Surtitling is coming along slowly. There's sign language interpretation occasionally. So it's coming along. However, and it's used by many, right? You see it in the gym, you see it in pubs, you see it all over the place. However, a lot of information is missing. And perhaps for those who are blind, you don't really care. But for those who are deaf, they care a lot, or they should care a lot, because things like music, sound effects, and the intonation in the voice, that's all gone. They don't get that. And when you're watching a piece of content, as you know, and as the awardee, Louise, said, there's a lot of emotion in that, and it's really important to the content, and directors and editors spend a long time making that part work. Almost as much time as the visuals. And so why is that missing? It shouldn't be missing. That's crazy. And it's because it wasn't designed from the beginning by the people who are actually producing the content. Because if it was, then something would have been done about a long time ago. So I do some work in how to make that, how to caption that kind of information. And then we moved into audio description for a good reason. And what I noticed was that audio description is following the same process that's going on as captioning. And it shouldn't follow that, because there's too many mistakes that have been made in captioning. And to try and now get those mistakes addressed has been a really difficult problem, because captioning's been around for a long time, and it's been in the regulations for a long time, and the broadcasters say, hey, we're doing it. Stop bugging us. Okay, so we can't, in the audio description community, we have an opportunity to not follow what's happening in captioning, because it's newer and there's more opportunity, I think. Okay, so the key concepts then that I brought into audio description and the research we're doing is that we're trying to use an inclusive design model. We're trying to use the social model of disability. We always take a user-centered design model. And the other thing that maybe isn't surprising to you, but articulating it made it come to the forefront, is that people who are deaf or people who are blind or people who are deafblind want to be entertained just as much as everybody else. Hey, here we go. They don't want to be informed. It's not about information. It's about entertainment. And who's responsible for the entertainment? From our theory? The creative team. That's right. Okay, so the creative team needs to be involved, and they want to be involved, from what we've looked at. And the other thing that's a really big bonus for audio description is that it is a creative process. Decisions have to be made by somebody. Vocabulary levels, speed, all those things are creative decisions. And so it has a creative component to it. And my work with Josh Mille also promised that, and the work that we've done, is that amateurs do have a place. There's been audio description since there's been blind people, and that's usually been done by family members, friends. It just never got recorded. And so as there's a very large community of audio describers. Maybe they're not the best audio describers in the world, but they're pretty good. Okay, so what happened with audio description? So as I said, we take a user-centered design approach, and a number of my blind friends and colleagues were talking to me about audio description. They hated it. This was back in 2004. And I said, well, why do you not like that? I didn't know that much about it at that time, not like Joel, who's very knowledgeable. And what they told me is that they were disappointed. They weren't being entertained, and it was getting in the way of their entertainment. So they turned it off. So a lot of my friends weren't even listening to it at all, because they found it getting in the way. I went, okay, well, I wonder why did they do that? So then I went looking, and didn't find very much. And I'm an academic, so I got to look in the literature first. And there was very, very little. And there's a little bit from the UK, a little bit from GBH, a very little, tiny little bit. And I noticed that what was happening was there was that similarity to captioning. It was done after the fact by somebody else. It was given away. And that there was a big fight. You know, it was a huge uphill battle to try and get anything done. And it hasn't changed that much, I think. The other thing was that it was the same approach for every show. So if you had drama, the audio description was the same as comedy, documentaries, everything. It was all the same. But the show's not the same. You know, directors don't take the same approach. That's not how it works. And so it wasn't following an entertainment model. And again, it wasn't like captioning. It wasn't following this universal design, inclusive design model, where it should happen from the beginning, not the retrofit at the end. All right, so So these were the things I found. I said, okay, well, you know, given that the entertainment should be a priority, I need to go talk to some directors. And I did that. And we found some directors in the Toronto area wanting to be more innovative. Digital media was becoming more prominent in the television and film industries, and they really wanted to push some boundaries. So we worked with the director and producer of Odd Job Jack in 2005, and they took on audio description and said, yes, of course you're right. We should be doing this. This is not your job. Stay away. Like, okay. So we worked with them on some of the golden rules of audio description. I have a blind postdoc who works in my lab, so she talked to them about, you know, what made sense from her point of view. And so the scriptwriter of the show decided to write the audio description script and decided that they wanted to use a first-person narrative form. And Odd Job Jack is one of these... too bad John Ray's not here. He hates Odd Job Jack. Poor guy. Well, you know, I'm not a big fan either. The audience, target audience is really 18 to 35-year-old males. What can you do, right? The director decided that, and the scriptwriter, that the main character, actor, voice talent was going to be the describer because he was the first person narrator in the first place, and he was going to describe from the future. And so, I can show you this a little bit. Let me just, let's just cue it for you. It's an animated adult comedy about an unemployed sociologist, which is not an unusual situation, doing a odd job. Sorry if anybody's a sociologist. I'm an engineer, so I get to do that. So he takes on all these very strange, odd jobs. He works for a temporary job agency. And so all the episodes are about all these crazy things he does. This is the first one that they did. He is responsible for driving a Wienermobile that looks like the Oscar Mayer Wienermobile. You know, it's hot dog on wheels. To a wiener eating contest. And the wieners are alien wieners that have been made by the aliens. I know. Well, I didn't make this stuff up. And now you know how many times I had to watch this?
Vegan hot dogs, are they?
No. I don't know. They're whatever. Anyway, this is just one very short clip where he's competing, driving across the country, and he goes between the U.S. and Canada sort of mysteriously, and there's a competing group, French-Canadian, who drive a French fry truck. I know, of course. And they get into a little bit of a fight about who's going to get there first or whatever it is. And they pick up, they had picked up a transvestite hitchhiker on the way, Priscilla. So she's in here too. You will hear, this is an integrated audio described clip from this. Okay, so just a minute.
It was the cops, the Frenchmen, the angry farmer.
Pull over, Wiener. We know all about the tainted meat.
Tainted meat?
Get rid of the evidence.
How do we do that?
Leave it to me.
You started scarfing sausages.
Griselda, help him out.
But my girlish figure. Screw it.
There was a French fry truck to the left of me, tofu truck to the right. Priscilla poured cooking oil out the back with wild abandon. Cars slid off the road. Suddenly, Jock hurled himself onto our windshield. Bobby, take the wheel. We met atop the wiener and fought. He landed a right, then he landed a left. Then I fell on my ass. Jock turned to find himself face to face with a fast approaching underpass.
Mama.
He fell into the...
Okay. So, there you go. And, we had a...
In the 35, did you say?
Okay, I know. Okay. We can send you the whole series, if you like. Right. They've all been audio described.
That's right.
And, We did a the Valerie, who's here, kindly agreed to describe that episode with a conventional form, and then we compared them. So this was the first time that there was an alternative to the conventional description for comparison. And overwhelmingly, I'm sorry, Valerie, you did a lovely job. It was great. But the blind audience, customers and clients, we call them subjects or participants that came, we had, I don't know, about 25 people, overwhelmingly liked the integrated version because it was more fun. And it fit that particular show really well. And then we showed it to a group of people just off the street because we have, you know, because it was entertaining, we thought, oh, well, you know, people whose eyes are otherwise busy, like when they're driving or cooking or whatever, might like it too. So we randomly chose a whole bunch of people from the street and showed them this and asked them, would they pay for something like this to have it in their car? And everybody said they would pay for it. Not a whole lot, but they would pay for it. This is why audio description has a better opportunity than captioning, because if it's an entertaining audio track, the whole thing, then people will want to have it when their eyes are busy. So they want to listen to their shows on their drive to work. Or, you know, I live in Thunder, I'm from Thunder Bay. It takes me about 18 hours to drive from Toronto to Thunder Bay. And I can listen to, you know, a whole series in that time if I had some good audio description. Okay. If I had some entertaining audio description. Not that it's not good. Some of it's really good, but some of it's not so good. Okay, and it's not necessarily because the describers are not working, they're doing their best. It's because the director, the interpretation of the show is inconsistent with the show itself. And so, you know, that's not the fault of the audio describer necessarily, because they're usually under a lot of time pressure, is what I found. But the creative team's not involved to help give direction, which is what they need to do. All right, so then we did a whole lot of different live events because we wanted to look at, well, what other people could do. This was only one director. What about some others? And so we worked with some different live events, Hamlet being one of them. And this was a university theater. And the director wanted the describer to take the role of Horatio. And if you know Hamlet, Horatio's the only guy left standing at the end. And Hamlet says to Horatio, you need to go forward and tell this story so it doesn't repeat. And so that made sense, that Horatio was going to be the storyteller, the describer, in the show. And so a Shakespearean actor took on the role of Horatio as describer from the future. And he wrote the description in iambic pentameter because that's what the director wanted. She wanted it to stay with the Shakespearean form that was being used in the play. So he did that. He is a Shakespearean actor, so he was trained in that kind of thing. And we introduced the touch tour at that point. And we had about 80 people come to that show. As I said, and I would you like to hear just a very short clip of Hamlet? I just want to watch the time. All right, so there's no visuals for this. Again, taping in live theater, that was a bit tricky. So hang on. Okay. You know, the quality of the audio recording
and
is not
so
the best.
So we go to find and teach our prince to speak of what was learned upon the tower. A great ball is set within the castle, in the grandest room, as wide and high and clear. All paths, stairs, landings in the castle large lead to the hall of the celebration. The ball, inflamed in fire, from torches lit, is full of courtiers and ambassadors.
The music isn't on. Sorry,
the
it's a stereo.
The lords and ladies dance. They dance.
And we don't have a stereo system
and
here.
And they drink with courtly manners, ply their country games.
there's laughing and stuff. That's on that second track, on the stereo track.
The lords spin their ladies, lift and toss them high, and all in dance and drink give joy this night. At once the king and queen enter the ball, with Polonius following in suit. The queen in velvet with jewels and trim of gold, the king with strength in new crown atop his head.
All right, so that would have been accompanied with some other sounds and some music and laughing and nice, eh? It was beautiful, actually. I like Shakespeare very much. Oh, I'm sorry. I said A. Right. Okay. And then that same year, we worked with the Ryerson Fashion School to describe a fashion show. And how many people here have ever been to a fashion show? Anybody? Really? Wow. I'm impressed. Me neither. It was like a scary kind of thing. I was so happy we had description, because I would have had no idea. A dress is a dress, as far as I'm concerned. So I learned a lot about different fabrics and buttons and things that you put on clothes. But the description was done by a fashion student who had been trained as a color commentator. And so she decided to take a color commentary approach to the description of the fashion show. And do you want to hear just one little quote, a little tiny thing? I have to switch. Now, again, you know, these are pretty old tracks. So this is a kids' collection.
Length sleeve princess dress with square cut neckline.
You see the well, it doesn't matter. You don't need to see it anymore.
And a cream colored dress with gold chiffon underlays shown through slit in the front. The girls are waving to the audience. The audience is waving back. Oh God, they're so cute.
So, you know, it was so, the girls were all kind of confused, and it was so cute, and it was the perfect description for that particular part of the fashion show. You know, and they were wearing chiffon dresses, so I learned that that's what chiffon looks like.
But it's
It was very...
cute as subject.
But they were so cute. all right. And every time we did these particular, all of our audio described events, we always did research. We always asked for user reaction. So we did pre and post questionnaires that, you know, went through ethics and were validated and had all that scientific parts to them. And we had overwhelmingly positive response in favor of the integrated audio description. As I said, we did a market survey to find out that people who are sighted would actually pay for something like this. And that was a really positive result. People liked the touch tours. They really enjoyed that. And all the touch tours we did were carried out by either the stage manager or the director of the show. So they learned a lot. I learned a lot about how the show was built and how the sets were built and how they were integrated into that particular story. I have a picture of Warhorse up here. And Warhorse is a play that includes puppets, life-size puppets. And they're super intricate, my goodness. And we had an excellent touch tour with the puppets. The puppeteers were actually the ones who did the touch tour, and they explained all about how the puppets were made and all the different pieces and how they held the puppets and how the actors got to climb onto the puppets. They were horses, so some of the actors actually rode on those horses, and they had to carry them, and the breathing and all that stuff that they did, it was really quite excellent. I learned a lot from that. I learned a lot. So did everybody. Throughout, you know, blind and sighted audience members tried the audio description or used it, and Everybody that we interviewed agreed that they benefited from having it. So a sighted audience benefited for sure. And any of the sighted companions that came on the touch tours definitely benefited. So since that time, we've done a whole host of different productions, 10 theater productions, ranging from, you know, a grade 8 school play, and I'll just tell you quick about that because it was really fun, through a blind playwright, blind describers, commercial community theater, so the whole gamut of different kinds of theater. We did one circus, the fashion show, 21 television shows, which has been really interesting. And again, all of these have had creative control. None has been done independently. One film and three are in production. And just the grade 8 play. Do you really want the story? My son was failing drama. And I had to do something about that because how, it's like failing gym, you know? How do you fail drama? It's grade 8. He just really didn't like drama. So I suggested to him and a couple of his friends that maybe they should consider doing the audio description for their school play. And the drama teacher / director loved that idea, and so did they. Because that meant they got out of the play, kind of. They didn't know, but they're in for. And so the actor who did Hamlet worked with them for a couple of hours, and they had to. So it was the play was Fiddler on the Roof, and the director, the teacher, wanted them to take on the role of the fiddler. And the fiddler is a very interesting character in Fiddler on the Roof. And so they had to go and research that character and why the fiddler is part of that play and what that the role is and how it works into that play. And they had to keep a log of all the things they did. They wrote the audio description themselves with the help of the teacher and the actor. And they delivered it on the day of the play. And there was a pre-show event that happened that nobody kind of knew about. So they had to describe that on the fly. And they did an amazing job, actually. So there were four of them, and they traded off and practiced, and they went to the rehearsals and did all that stuff. And then they submitted their learning journal, and we wrote a paper that's in an educational theater journal. And it was a lot of fun. So my son went from failing drama to getting an award and an A+. Yay. So the teacher really enjoyed that process, and she did the touch tour. They didn't want that. So what's happened as a result of the research that we've been doing in Toronto? We're finding that directors are starting to embrace the idea of audio description, and that it is their responsibility. It doesn't mean they have to do it. It doesn't mean that even their company has to do it. But it does mean that if they're going to hire a third party or bring in a third party, they still need to look after it. They need to supervise it. They need to hear it. And they need to make the decisions about the style and the approach that's going to be taken. And we've had all kinds of people. We've had director-described description, and here's an example of one for a film. We've had producers and executive producers involved. We've had deluxe involved, bringing in executive producers and an audio description company to make decisions about the audio description for the TV series that they did. So we've had teams that work together, and that works well. We've been working a lot with theater students at my university. We have a theater program and a radio and television arts program, and I've been working fairly hard with instructors and the chairs of those departments to bring in audio description training and knowledge into their program, their training programs. And the next thing I'm working on, you'll be happy about this, Joel, is that audio description and captioning, because I do work in captioning as well, are a requirement for their fourth-year production pieces.
Cool, yes.
So they must do that. We've built a number of tools to help people make audio description and captioning as well. And they've been designed for everybody to use. So They're not professional tools. They're for amateur tools, and we've done quite a bit of research with amateurs and how they use these tools and what they come up with. And so that's available as a software application, but it's also for web. The web and Google is implementing it into YouTube. So they funded us to do that. There's other tools with Josh's group. There's UDescribe and some other ones that are coming along. And the Japanese are actually hot on this trail as well with tools. But they're quite a big advocate of the computer voices.
Yeah.
We'll see how that goes.
Amazing.
They have, yeah, they have. And the other thing that's changing is practice. Thanks to Joel, the Americans are actually starting to consider these ideas. The Europeans are starting to embrace this. The Canadians have not, and I'm kind of disappointed about that. They don't seem to like our literature, the research that's been done in Canada. But everybody else is, and they might catch up someday. And the Japanese are changing, the Australians are changing, and so it's just a matter of time. Two new standards, one from the ISO and one from the ITU, have been developed with this concept that audio description is a creative process from as a basis, and things will go from there. And then, of course, we're trying to look at business models. So I'm in a business school, and, you know, I heard yesterday how hard it is to, in the theater in particular, the people talking about theater, how hard it was to even get the audio description track, never mind talk to the creative people.
Right.
And, you know, instead of fighting that battle, and it's always going to be a fight, because there's a lot of pressure on the creative teams. They have a lot to do, and they're working pretty hard. And then adding one more thing, whatever it is, into their list of things to do is a pretty tough fight. And I'm not sure if it's worth doing that only. If you can give them a reason to include it, other than the theoretical reason, like they should be doing it because it's part of the show, if we can give them some business reason, if you add in the audio description, you have a new product that you can sell afterwards, just like, you know, the music tracks for the show or whatever, then they might actually start to listen a little bit harder. Yes, of course. And it's available at everybody. It'll be available at every performance. And so I've been working with our accounting team, researchers at Ryerson, on these models, these business models. We've published a couple of things. The people at Odd Job Jack looked at the accounting model and did a fair bit of work on how their how audio description fit into their business process, and they figured for them it was cheaper for them to do it in house than to farm it out. That's for them. That's not for everybody. The other thing with Odd Job Jack that they learned was that if they do it in-house, they got control over the technical. So audio description got put into the master mix process. So the master went out with audio description in it. And so they had control of volume levels and speed, so they could speed up the audio description. It was a bit slow. And they had complete control of all those technical components. And it was such a nice technical piece of work. It was also entertaining that the Comedy Network ordered all their shows to be done like that from Odd Job Jack, or from Smiley Guy Studios. So I think there's a big opportunity here to look at that side of things, the business side of things, and have a different model than captioning has. Captioning, I don't know, I can't figure out the model for that. There's one somewhere, I think, but audio description, there is a model, a business model that we can put forward as a group that I think people will start to listen to. Do you want to hear one more little piece? This was done... And this is a really important piece to the work that we're doing in the future. This is a film called Magical Coincidence, and it was debuted at the Real Asian Film Festival. Keith Locke is the director, and he decided that he was going to be the describer because he was just quite keen on this, and you'll see why. Because the approach that he took, and that particular film festival is looking at Asian culture, and so he was looking at a mixed couple, so mixed cultural couple, and he was exploring those ideas in this film. I'm not going to show you the whole film. If you want to see it, I can certainly give you a link to it, but I'll just show you the beginning because it's interesting, his approach. And I know we've got video
here. Creative decisions in this story were made by a coin toss. Wonderslate Films presents Magical Coincidence. A flickering Super 8 image of a crowd of people moves like a jerky impressionist painting. An elderly man in a bike helmet pedals an indoor bicycle contraption. This is a generator, and it's powering a little Super 8 projector. The light from the projector falls on the screen. A balding Asian man in his 30s plays a rickety piano in an old...
So the film, I think, is 15 minutes long. And we had, again, a fairly large blind audience come to see it. And they were Chinese. And that was a really interesting thing that happened there. So they were, some were Chinese and some were English, actually. So here's just a slide of iJub Jack. So from that, a lot of the Chinese said, well, you know, this is the first time that I've actually seen a Chinese film in Canada that had audio description in it for me. I'm like, good point. So we have a very large immigrant population in Toronto from all different places, and they have nothing. They have no audio description. Unless they speak English, they have no access to films or television because there's no audio description in other languages. I know in the U.S. there's work in Spanish, and we do have French, but if you speak Chinese, you're out of luck. So what our new research project is looking at the cultural context. And we're working with three different film festivals. The First Nations, so that's Aboriginals. Deaf filmmakers, how about that? And we're working again with the Asian filmmakers, and they want to do all their films. And, you know, I don't know what a First Nations describer would, what kind of cultural context they would bring to a First Nations film. And I'm really curious to try and understand what that means, because they have different storytelling traditions and different ways in which they will describe things. And so we're working with them to do that. The deaf filmmakers, again, they have a very different way of interacting with sound. But they're also very visual individuals, so they pay attention to visual information a lot more than hearing people. So I'm quite curious to find out what a kind of approach they would take. It's going to be very different than anything else, I'm sure. And then the other thing that's happening is we're working with Zaga Entertainment, who is rolling out now as we speak, actually, the audio-described version of Netflix. Everybody understands Netflix, so it's Netflix is here. Netflix has been a very difficult partner. They have not been a partner. So we're doing it ourselves. And the model that we're going to take, again, because it's at Ryerson, and the person running it is a blind man who went to Ryerson, did his master's with me, and he wants to... He likes the idea of different styles for different shows, and we're going to be working with the theater students at Ryerson. We've had a lot of success with that, I must say, to do the audio description work. I want to build a little sort of consulting company or audio description student company at Ryerson that will train students, film students, and theater students, actors in audio description and work with SAGA to produce this content. It's all online. There's no TV component, no over the air component. Okay, any questions? There's a question.
Oh, okay.
Do we have a question? Do you want to?
Yeah, sure. No, Alex, did you ever? Let me give you a microphone. Sure.
I was just wondering if we want to get involved with Ryerson as far as working on some of these projects, what kind of opportunities there are out there. I, as well, am from Canada, from the West Coast.
Okay. Right. I'm going to go to this microphone.
Yeah.
How's that sound? I'm just going to take it out of the thing here. There's lots of opportunities. If you are interested in grad school, I would like to talk to you. I'm at the university, so you know I tend to do this in research. I actually think it's unethical for me to provide audio description service through the university because I can do it cheaper and all that kind of stuff. And I just don't think that the university should be in the business of competing with the private sector businesses. So if you're interested in that kind of thing, we don't do that. I like to work with the private sector companies, but I don't want to provide audio description service from the university. I just really disagree with that. But I want to push boundaries. I want to, we work with a lot of people. We try and listen to a lot of the concerns, solve the problems that people are running into. The other thing that I have at Ryerson, which most other people in the private sector have, I have huge access to the industry. Ryerson is really well known in the film and television and radio industries. I meet people who've graduated from there in all over the place, in broadcast companies everywhere. And so I've got access to that because they're Ryerson alum and because we have a lot of relationships with the theaters and directors and things like that. They come to Ryerson. They're associated with Ryerson. So that puts me in a unique position to be able to work with them in a way that that the private sector just can't.
Oops, thank you. Hi. I'm sorry, did that answer your question, Alex? Yes.
So come to Ryerson. Come and do your master's, PhD. Be great.
Hello, my name is Stacia, and I have two questions. The first one is, can we get access to your PowerPoint presentation and
Absolutely.
To your research?
Absolutely.
And my other question is, my company, we produce audio description, audio process products, in addition to interpretive materials. And one of the arguments, and Joel, you might want to weigh in on this, that we have, or one of the challenges we have, is we always take the position that anything that we are doing should go to the person first, And I almost burst into tears. I saw the thing, entertainment is about having fun and being engaged, and that people want to be entertained as if it's some kind of revelation.
I know.
But a lot of the people that we work for who have hired us, and Joel, I'm sure you've had the same experience, I actually have turned in audio described scripts that have had every adjective stripped from them, have had every moment of emotion, every moment of context. When you're encountering people, or what would you say to challenge that purchaser of audio description who is not the consumer of audio description, to help them understand that this is a human experience that we are trying to convey? We are trying to, in a way, not insert ourselves between the consumer and the product, but we are trying to build a bridge between that product and that consumer.
Well, what happens is the audio description track is how a blind audience consumes that product. That's the way they do it. That they're not able to have access the other components. And so as an audience, and so the purchaser of your audio description script and the services, if you're dealing with the account manager for the show, which is probably the case, or somebody in the the person who's ticking off the box that they phoned you, what you need to try and do, and we've done this from the Ryerson, from the university point of view, is I always insist that either the executive producer, the producer, the director, stage manager, whatever, has to be part of the initial meeting. And usually, when they come to the initial meeting, they're like, you, account manager, you got to get out of the way here. I need to deal with this. And they start to take responsibility because they, you know, they care about the content. You need to make sure the person who cares about the content is part of the decision process. And I know that's really hard to do initially, but executive producers, you know, that's part of their job, actually. So, you know, saying, well, the executive producer needs to be part of the initial meeting your needs and things like that.
Boy, you're absolutely right. Most film directors, when we were getting I think you were talking about museum tours to some extent, but, you know, to take film. Most film directors, when we're getting the production to be described after the fact, retrofitting it, the film director is doing three films hence.
Oh, yeah, later.
He's gone.
It's like gone.
He's gone.
Gone home.
You know what I mean? And,
that's right.
The only time... two times that I've ever had a director actually want to review the description before son was A, Woody Allen, because he didn't really know what this was. And when he figured out what it was in his brain, he said, oh, yeah, okay, whatever. And that didn't really, right? And then the other director was my daughter. When she did a film, she was going to have it audio described and subtitles, because it was being shown in France. But well, partly because I insisted, but anyway, but she said, "Fine, you can do audio description. I want it described, but I'm going to watch the. I want to see the script, and I want to be." And she made suggestions and ideas. I mean, the idea for in museums. What's wonderful in a way about doing description with museums, if you can work with the curator.
Yes,
the curator is the artist, best thing.
The curator's, it's usually the curator's vision
expressed. And you can,
in that
they can
exhibit.
Help direct you as to what's most important to describe, et cetera,
right.
And how, and
right.
Such, you know.
Yes.
It's not that far from the exhibit designer to the architect.
Right. Exhibit designer to the architect.
Part of the other component to this is, you know, it's important for us to get to the students. You know, that doesn't help the people who are already in the business, but the new people coming into the business, you know, are educated at our universities. And, you know, if we can get to that group of people, then we start to, you know, encourage people to take responsibility for it. And it's actually, they don't need to be encouraged. Everybody that I've worked with, even Disney, you know, have said, well, you know, you guys can't actually do this on your own. We have to supervise this. This is our show. And, you know, I'm like, absolutely. Of course, it's your show. I mean, nobody should be doing you don't send out the costume to somebody else and hope they come back on the day of the performance correctly. You know, why would you think, you know, the audio description and captioning, I have the same opinion about captioning, would be done any differently than set design or costumes, because it's all part of the show. And, you know, as soon as they think about it that from that point of view, you know, usually you can't get them away from, you know, which is fine. That's what they should have.
Yeah, hi. My name's Stu Bush. I'm with Blind Alive. We do eyes-free fitness programs. And I was really intrigued, actually, about not the professional aspect, but the amateur aspect.
Yeah.
I can claim to be an amateur describer for some 33 years now. And so I do agree that amateurs have a place, but I'm terrible at it.
Oh, yeah.
Right. So, you know, to be honest, I mean, just to be frank, and I'm a very visual person, and I sometimes really struggle getting the visual into language. And one of the challenges I would put out to you guys is, how do we do that? What was the phrase you used? One size fits one.
Right.
Sort of thing. The ultimate of that is training people like me not in the three-day course that Joel's about to teach, which is great for professional certification, right? But teaching people like me how to do a better job of helping this young lady over here understand the what's going on in the world. So anyways, I put a plea out to this community to see what we can do there.
And so Live Describe has been designed for an amateur audience. And one of the things that Josh and I have been working on is a training concept for people who are amateurs. So, you know, you're describing something, a fitness, why not record it and put it up in the DVX format or, you know, with Live Describe, whatever, and then put it up. And, you know, if people don't like your description, they're not going to listen to it. And, you know, we can use a rating and they'll, and, you know, as you get feedback from your audience, it'll help you too. So, and, you know, we did a study with amateurs and we had a range, a nice normal distribution of really bad ones and really good ones and a bunch in the middle. And, you know, we had about 100 blind participants rate these amateur descriptions. And the training that we gave people was, you know, about 15 to minutes to a half an hour, and you know, we had a good selection, so it was, you know, that's absolutely true. Description is a difficult task. It's a cognitively intense, difficult task, as everybody who's done any description knows, and you're not everybody's going to be good at it. However, you know, actor training, there's a lot of things that we can bring from the training of actors.
Absolutely.
Who are learning things. You probably could.
Well, yeah, absolutely. No, and that's, I have pressed Josh on this repeatedly that, you know, okay, you describe, Live Describe, but not just y'all come and put up whatever kind of crap. There's got to be a training module.
There does.
I'm going to go to Terry Grossman for a question but or comment, but I do want to say with respect to captions, I got to tell you a quick story. The great director, not the actor Peter Sellers, but there's a wonderful director out there, opera director, and our, he was at the Los Angeles Opera. Well, he's an old friend. I've got to know him through panels at the National Endowment for the Arts, and he tells the story of many years ago doing an opera, and this was right when opera started doing surtitles. And they were doing surtitles because they were getting a groundswell of folks, their own subscribers and such, saying, you know what? We need to know what these folks are saying because we don't know Italian. We don't know German. And so we're going to have these surtitles, these words at the top of the stage. They're telling Peter, the director of the opera. And he said, you're not putting words at the top of my stage. No, I'm in charge of the stage picture. You want me to have words on the And Peter, genius that he is, when he realized, of course, he had no choice, he made it his choice and incorporated it within the production. So you had surtitles, all right. You had surtitles at the top, at the bottom, on the sides, in colors.
Right.
Not just, you know, willy-nilly, but in a way that matched his vision for his production.
There you go.
So that's, I think it's very much what you're talking about.
It is. Yeah. It is.
Deborah, I've only found, first of all, people I can talk to are the independent filmmakers. They care very deeply about seeing my script before we record it. And
yes,
so,
good.
Yeah, they really get on board. Frequently, they are intrigued by the idea of expanding the audience for their great creation. And so they're generally really, really nice to work with.
Yeah.
Hollywood, not so much.
Right. And you know, I know this. I understand this. You know, we helped Don McKellar work on Blindness, which won the whatever at Cannes the year it was released. And he had a... So, you know, there's a lot of work to do, for sure. But I think it's worth doing. And, you know, the post-production houses like Technicolor and Deluxe, they're pretty well on board on this one. And they have a lot of sway with directors. Because the directors come in to those companies for their post-production editing. It's not, it's still not at the beginning or enough at the beginning, but at least it's before release. It's before delivery.
Interesting.
So they'll
Deluxe here in the person of Chelsea
Poncho. Yes, you do.
She's taking notes, I see, over there.
So the Deluxe in Canada has been really great to work with, actually. They are phoning us. They said, you have to come now. We have this director, and we're going to do this. And so they've been really proactive in that area. And we're now out of that. They're working with a company they do all kinds of film and television and theater stuff. So they'll do costumes and whatever. They're now doing audio description. They're using our theater students, and they're working with Deluxe on their own, which is what I want.
Cool.
That's, I don't want to be, I want the companies that are doing this to actually work with this.
Deb, let's get a perspective from down under, way down, and down under and to the right.
You're right, the New Zealanders.
Right?
Kia ora from Nicola from New Zealand. I was really excited to hear particularly some of the last things you were saying there about the cultural context, because at the moment we don't have any Māori audio describers in New Zealand.
No,
we don't have any description on Māori TV,
right.
And there's nobody remotely qualified to engage in particularly things like cultural performance, and so I'd be really interested to talk to you both about the bicultural, the bilingual context, but also the cultural context around First Nations
and
stuff.
But you have Maori actors.
And so that's kind of where this starts to get exciting. How do we start to pull out that? But I actually wanted to ask you a question, because I'm really interested in what you're talking about, getting the creative, how people engage with the creative process. And I suppose, and I'm thinking about, we've got a show coming up later this year that's a youth production, and all of the audio describers, me included, are far too old to consider being the describers on that,
actually.
And how we get that, right, how we get the language right, so it's not going to be incongruous with the show. But my question is, I suppose, about how we make sure that the description still makes sense for a blind audience, which is what we're still doing. And what I want to give is a little example, which is out of blindness but back into deafness, and it was these people were very interested in integrating sign language into a film and having deaf experience in a film, and so they made a film, they involved a deaf character in it, they subtitled the deaf character for the hearing audience to understand what the deaf character was signing, but failed to put in any subtitles signing, so that a deaf audience couldn't participate in that. And it's quite an extreme example of somebody really kind of stuffing the process up. But I suppose, my fear is that if creative people without the kind of understanding of what it is they're trying to do for a blind audience get very creative and excited, which would be lovely, but if they take it in the wrong direction, then we're not going to get something that blind people can enjoy. And so how do you stop them?
You're absolutely right on that. And, that's one of the roles that we take on as the research team. And so, yes, there needs to be some training opportunities and educational opportunities for those in the creative business to learn about, some of the do's and don'ts with audio description. But the good thing is that there's a lot of things in, if they're trained actors, that they can draw from. And there's not that many don'ts in audio description, but they do need to learn what those are, and they need to understand some of the pitfalls that that they can fall into as visual or sighted people. Different people will take different amounts of times. There's lots of examples that they can use. There's now hopefully going to be some international standards which they maybe will identify with that can help them with that as well. So, you're right, absolutely. And but there is some stuff that we use to do that.
Nicola reminds me of when I played
I played a Tevye and Fiddler on the Roof from an orchestra pit. It was a production of Fiddler on the Roof at the Model Secondary School for the Deaf, which is adjacent to Gallaudet. So I was the sucker in the booth, and not in the booth, in the pit, voicing Tevye, singing the songs for the poor unfortunate hearing people who came to the show, because otherwise it was just the silent experience, everybody was signing. So that was sort of cool, you know. Albert.
I think I missed a little bit about the Chinese audience, you know, the consumers. And for the movie, is it the description is speaking Chinese or English?
You didn't get to see the whole show. And, you know, the director was exploring this idea of cross-cultural confusion, right? You saw how he thought about the show, right? All the decisions were made by a coin toss. And so there was a Chinese man speaking Italian. There was a
Chinese man speaking Italian.
There was a Canadian woman speaking Chinese. A Caucasian Canadian speaking Chinese, not Chinese. There was Mandarin. There was Cantonese.
Right.
It was all confused. And the whole point was about this cross-cultural confusion. That was the whole point of the movie. And so the description had some of that in it, because he wanted it to be like that. The visuals were like that, the soundtrack was like that, and so was the description. So it was interesting. There was some Mandarin, there was some Cantonese, there was English, but that's what he wanted to explore. I think that the new films that are going to be in that show won't be like that. If they are in Mandarin, then the audio description will be in Mandarin. But it will be done from the... So it's a Canadian film festival, and all the filmmakers are Canadian, as far as I'm pretty sure. And so they will be making decisions that way about how to do the audio description, what language it should be in. You know, if the show's in Mandarin, the audio description should be in Mandarin.
Right. But their native language is Canadian, right? I mean,
no, that
was a joke. I'm sorry, it was a joke. Alex wants to ask about how to get his PhD.
Oh, good. Come to Rosen.
Not quite, but Deborah, it's you just had a question about those of us that do retrofit audio description, and if you have any advice for what kind of creative involvement we can get at that point,
right,
when it seems like it's almost too late to get any.
Yes.
But...
Well, and you know, in the U.S. and in Canada, still, the broadcasters are responsible because they're controllable through their licensing, and, you know, the FCC and the CRTC can control them where they don't control studios. So they're usually the ones responsible for doing all this stuff. Right, they've got to get it. They've got the cap. They have to do the captions. They've got to go get the audio description, and that's often. You're right. It is almost too late.
Yeah.
However, you know, they will provide you with access to the creative team if you push it.
Yeah.
And if you can't, you know, that's the way it is. You've got to do the best you can.
The conventional audio description
is what you're going to be
there,
doing.
And it is something. And what I like about, and the reason I wanted Deb to be here is so that we could push the envelope a little bit in our thinking. And Lord knows, you know, I've been doing the conventional description for a long time.
You have.
That's
okay. Doing it very well.
Well, fine. But I just love the notion that there are ways to stretch and do different things. Now, I would pose a question, or maybe mostly it's a comment, I guess. You know, I mentioned, I think, at one point, one of the sessions, Theater by the Blind, which is now Theater Breaking Through Barriers. And they were doing, probably well before
they were
incorporating the description right there within the production. So it was part and parcel with the production. Yep. So every performance was audio described.
Right.
Great. But what do we do about the situation we found ourselves in the year 2000, when the FCC had issued its rules on description for broadcast television? It was struck down in a court of law, and then it took us 10 years to get a law passed in Congress, but it was struck down on a technicality because they said, no, no, Congress told FCC to do a report. They didn't tell you to issue the rules and actually go with it. They said do a report. And that was cert, that was true, and so the rules fell. But one of the arguments that was made in court was that you can't, it was a First Amendment argument.
Creative,
you cannot force us to make speech. If we make a film or television show and that's what we did, and we like it. And you're telling us we have to add language to it. We have to change our creative product,
right.
And we don't want to. Can't do that. Now, that argument didn't, I don't believe it even got voiced, but, because it was going to be struck down on technicality anyway. But our rebuttal to that we worked on and played with, was, no. We're not artists. No, we're just like captioners. We're just like translators. We're simply translating what can be seen to words. We don't change anything. We're not, so please don't consider us artists. We're just like transcribers typing away or something.
Right.
So
yes,
we had to basically say that we were something that we really weren't, because we knew that there is a creative something
right.
here. And, we had to kind of betray that.
I read that, and I was sad when I saw that, because most likely the creative people didn't put forth that argument. It was the business people that were doing that, and under the guise that, you know, it was a creative thing that was going to be overridden. And just ridiculous.
Yeah. No, you're right. You're right.
It's ridiculous. It's a ridiculous argument. The other thing that they also cited was that there, you know, nobody wanted it. And I'm like, what?
Well,
because it doesn't exist. What are you talking about? Anyway,
no, that's the vicious circle.
It was a vicious circle, and there was not very much research published. There wasn't a lot of publication with user population. So people doing user surveys or whatever never published that anywhere. And so that's one of my motivations is I wanted to publish
people don't
user
want
studies.
It. I mean, that stage has probably run into this, and certainly performing arts people, when you're trying to convince a theater to do description or a museum, and not so much these days, but it's like, well, wait, description for people who are blind?
We don't do that
because we don't see many blind people around here. Well, they don't see many blind people because they don't offer description.
That's
and they
right.
don't offer description because they don't see many blind
that's
people.
Right,
they don't
right.
see many blind people because they don't offer description.
I know,
ridiculous.
It's a silly argument.
Dan Spoon has a question or comment.
Deborah, I really enjoyed your presentation. What, you know, my mind always goes to the business model, so that really intrigued me. And it seems like in the literary industry, in book publishing, obviously audiobooks are a huge product line, and they are, you know, they're basically narrations. They're not, you know, just somebody, you know, slowly
that's
reading
right.
the text that's in the book. It, you know, there's voices for the characters, there's inflection, and you're right, as a blind person, it's tremendously more entertaining. And as for sighted people who are, you know, not reading the book at the particular time they're listening, and so it seems like that is a very productive business model. And I'm just kind of curious to me why, you know, film doesn't see it that way, or television doesn't see it that way.
Well, when I looked at that of course was one of the areas that I looked into when I was looking at the business model, and the other thing about the audiobooks is that even during the crazy, you know, crash of the economy, audiobook sales were growing at 6% a year, every year. Mm. And so there's a huge market for that. There's another area where there's some interesting potential, and that's in the radio drama. Mm. And when I have older
blind audiences, I've worked with a couple of them, they always tell me, well, this is like radio drama, and that's what we want. And so there's a number of people working in the radio drama industry, especially in the UK. In Canada, unfortunately, our radio dramas are waning. I don't know about here, but still, PBS does some. And so there are people in the radio drama industry who can help inform what's going on in audio description, for sure. But yes, absolutely. And so there's a place for those two other industries in this world.
We're right up against break time. I just want to say that many of you know I spent 20 years in my day job but I loved it as a specialist for the Arts Endowment, the National Endowment for the Arts, and I directed the Inter-Arts Program, funding presenting organizations, anything that was multidisciplinary. And I remember, but I was doing accessibility all that time, of course, and drafting guidelines for the funding of new work, new interdisciplinary work that suggested to applicants that they could consider accessibility as an aesthetic innovation and apply to us for funding to do novel, innovative things with accessibility. I think that's what the gist is of Deborah's work with video and film in particular, with some live productions too. And I knew Deb would have an exciting and interesting, thought-provoking presentation for us. So, Deb, thank you so much for being with us
here. Welcome. Thank you. And I just put my our website up. It's www.imdc.ca, and all the video that I showed is on the website.
Right.
We have the rights to have those clips up if you're interested, plus a whole lot of others. and, you know,
we'll reconvene at 4 o'clock with our last formal session, and enjoy your break. We'll see you at 4.